You're listening to America's Most Challenging Issue, where Baha'iTeachings.org interviews community builders across the nation who are inspired by the Baha'i vision of the oneness of humankind. Join us as we explore their work, bringing about racial unity and establishing a more just and equitable society. I'm your host, Masoud Olufani. The groundbreaking recording, The Rose That Grew From Concrete, Volume 1, released in 2000, featured a series of poems by the late rapper and social critic Tupac Shakur that are interpreted by a collection of celebrated hip-hop artists, writers, and actors, reimagining Shakur's powerful words in beaded recitation set to pulsating beats. In the title track, the renowned American poet Nikki Giovanni draws on Shakur's compelling metaphor of a black rose growing through the cracks in the sidewalk as a symbolic representation of black children thriving in spite of the oppressive forces that seek to arrest their development, a bitter and enduring legacy of institutionalized racism. In a 1985 letter, the Universal House of Justice, the supreme governing body of the Baha'i world community, addresses the dire consequences for a society afflicted with the cancer of bigotry and injustice. They write, "Racism retards the unfoldment of the boundless potentialities of its victims, corrupts its perpetrators, and blights human progress. Recognition of the oneness of mankind, implemented by appropriate legal measures, must be universally upheld if this problem is to be overcome." Our guests today, Nasif Habibullah and Dr. Anthony Outler, are attentive gardeners of black roses, men dedicated to the restoration and cultivation of the discarded, the objectified, and the dehumanized. With 25 years of experience as a trained mediator specializing in substance abuse counseling and anger management in the Fulton County Jail System in Atlanta, Georgia, Baba Nasif, a venerated elder of the Atlanta Baha'i community, has committed his professional life to the redemptive work of restorative justice, mentoring incarcerated men struggling with the material and spiritual circumstances of their condition. Born in Montgomery, Alabama, and raised in Columbus, Georgia, he was drafted into the military following his high school graduation and served in the Vietnam War. After a brief affiliation with the Black Panther Party, Nasif began a deep spiritual search that would lead him first to the Nation of Islam under the leadership of Elijah Muhammad and eventually to the unifying teachings of the Baha'i faith. In addition to his rich and varied personal life, he is a devoted husband and dedicated father to two accomplished sons, Raphael and Dr. Anthony Outler, and a grandfather of two boys, Nadim and Justice. Anthony Outler has worked in education for nearly 20 years. An assistant middle school principal in Decatur, Georgia, his pedagogical approach is an extension of his community activism, which is primarily concerned with using culturally responsive, emancipatory educational practices to empower youth to transform their communities. He combines the intellectual rigor of a scholar with the passionate advocacy of a grassroots organizer. Inspired by the redemptive teachings of the Baha'i faith, he believes that the purpose of education is to empower youth to identify, resist, and ultimately abolish oppressive systems and institutions in order to build a better world. He earned his PhD in educational policy studies with a concentration in social foundations of education from Georgia State University. And in addition to his work in K-12 education, he works with adult learners as a faculty member for the Wilmette Institute course, Anti-Black Racism in the United States. As important as his service-oriented professional life is, his most important work is as a committed husband and father. Baba Nasif and Brother Anthony, welcome to America's Most Challenging Issue. You know, we are living through a really interesting historical moment, right? One that is informed by a past with deep roots. the murders of Brother Rashard Brooks, George Floyd, and Ahmaud Arbery, all caught on video, have galvanized a diverse coalition of activists and concerned citizens determined to confront the blight of racialized brutality. Black people in America know, of course, that state-sanctioned violence visited upon the black body is nothing new. It grows out of this long tradition that extends to the slave ship and the plantation fields and hanging trees of the Deep South. Now, you are both fathers who have raised and are raising black boys, and I'm wondering how that experience is informed by the very real threat of physical violence faced by African-American boys in public spaces. And Baba Nassif, I would love to hear you speak to this first, if that would be all right.
I think black men have to empower themselves around not being a victim, you know, not to fall victim to what is going on. Notice it, know how to maneuver it, but to also empower yourself with knowledge of self and have some direct goals on where you're going without, you know, all of the madness going on in the black community. You know, you got the black gangsters on one side and then you got the white cops on the other, you know. And so black men have to be particularly careful on how they maneuver in this world. So it's like moving in two worlds, still maintaining a sense of identity and still knowing, you know, where you're going without getting caught up on either side, you know, with the racism on one side and, you know, the what they call black on black violence on the other. Of course, we know that is a result of systemic racism. But so that's the kind of way, you know, it's giving them self-identity and being able to read what's going on as they maneuver in a racist society.
Absolutely. And I was just say this for me, you know, a lot of times you don't, as children, you know, we don't really understand, you know, some of the wisdom behind how we're being raised until we get older and able to reflect back. And so, you know, as my pop was talking, as I reflect back on how, you know, my brother and I were raised, identity was something that a positive cultural identity was something that you know, my pops definitely wanted to make sure that we had, because, you know, the understanding that, you know, we live in a society where narratives about what it means to be black and male are situated within a space of dysfunctionality, right? All the messages that we get from the media, you know, we look at TV, we see the music, there's this agenda to maneuver us into looking at and identifying ourselves in certain ways. And so we had, you know, my pops ensured that we were fortified from that. And the way he did that was through, you know, just exposing us to how racism works in our society, exposing us to these miseducation processes that go all the way back to 1619. This calculated attempt to take us out of our minds so that we would serve the aims, the materialistic aims of the white power structure. So understanding that and how that works was key, you know. And from a young age, I remember as a young teen, 12 years old, you know, I'm reading The Miseducation of the Negro. I'm reading, you know, books about apartheid in South Africa. I remember reading Kaffir Boy, you know, so he gave me those books to read, and all of it was part of a process of equipping me to be ready and to be able to read the society and navigate it so I don't fall into the traps that have been set out here for us. And so I look to duplicate those same things. I find myself duplicating those same methods with my own son, as I have a teenager now who's approaching seventh grade this year. So, yeah, so it's that's, you know, the wisdom that I can now see in how I was being raised.
Yeah, I think that's such an important thing to keep in mind, the difference between victimhood and being empowered through your test and your difficulties. And often, I find that in the general society, when a person has ill intent, when they're trying to scapegoat a racist ideology, they'll say, well, you know, don't ever refer to yourselves as, you know, you're not victims, you know, oh, you're playing the victim card. Now, of course, in the context of the Baha'i faith, it's a very different thing. We stand up for the principle, the spiritual principle of truth. It's the foundation of all human virtues. That doesn't mean when you're speaking the truth,
absolutely,
that's not about victimhood. That is actually helping to heal, to identify the sicknesses that afflict the society, which the diagnosis has to be made. We have to be clear about the illnesses that afflict the body politic in order to devise, you know, strategies to heal it.
Absolutely. Because it's some real victims out here, brother. You know, Baha'u'llah himself says, you know, that as Baha'is, we are to be upholders and defenders of the victims of oppression. Right. So, yes, you know what I mean? It's evident. It's clear. The truth is we have been victimized. But it's about, you know, as you were saying, you know, how do we translate? How do we conceptualize that experience? And then how do we then use that, you know, as motivation for us to move forward? And,
you know, one of the most compelling statements in the Baha'i writings addresses the spiritual distinction of people of African descent who are referred to as the people of the eye, through which the light of the spirit shines forth, according to the Baha'i writings. It is a statement of astounding significance, unique in its religious history. And because it uplifts a people who suffer the sustained trauma of marginalization and dehumanization, how does this Baha'i-inspired concept of the people of the eye inform the work that you do in the fields of restorative justice and education?
One of the things that when Anthony became Baha'i, one of the things that I noticed, some of the people in the Baha'i community had some issues, if you will, with Black identity, if you will. What I'm saying is that I think as a result of a white cultural construct in the West, unbeknownst to some of our white brothers and sisters, we have to maintain that station of people of the eye, because sometimes we can be co-opted into a white cultural construct of identity, and that white cultural construct of identity will not allow us to grasp what the manifestation Baha'u'llah has said we are. And if what happens is
we lose,
it's diluted. Our identity is diluted because pretty much start thinking it's Baha'i because it's being defined by another cultural group, you know, and that cultural group does not have that same designation. That designation for us implies detachment. Detachment from a construct that Baha'u'llah and the Guardian has specifically said has what they call it, a pernicious evil, you know what I mean? And we have to detach ourselves from that construct, identify with the spiritual principles of the faith in order to maintain or to even find out or to and be. And we can't compromise, you know, we can't make compromises on that. Sometimes, you know, the way people will look at it, you being rebellious, if you will. But the thing is that, I call us keepers of the covenant has to take form, you know, not in the form of hurting anybody or, you know what I mean, talking crazy to anybody, but it has to be guarded in the light of who Baha'u'llah say I am, you know what I mean? And not to co-opt or to compromise, you know, on that, on who we are. If we start doing that, we'll start losing the strength of who we really are as God said we are, you know what I mean? So people that I have is a place where I see Black Baha'is have to keep their eyes on that and not see it as a designation that is just given to you, but you still have to apply that in your daily life. And we're talking about basically with the oneness of mankind, you know what I mean? That still have to be the parameters which you work within, you know. Anything outside of that, you know, is detrimental to who we are as Black people.
That metaphor, you know, really, in essence, goes back to what I was sharing before, just in terms of that identity, right? There's a quote where the Baha'i Faith, where Baha'u'llah says, man is a supreme talisman. Lack of proper education hath, however, deprived him of what he inherently possesses. And so I think about that, right? And how improper education was one of the primary mechanisms used to dehumanize us and to create these narratives that kind of perpetuate the realities of race that exist in our world today. And so this whole understanding of what we inherently possess, and we've been called the pupil of the eye, we inherently possess certain qualities of the spirit that through proper education we're able to, you know, reveal what we inherently possess. In a recent message from the House of Justice, which is the supreme body of the Baha'i Faith, it talks about how racism deprives a portion of humanity from unleashing its capabilities. Right. And so in my work as an educator, you know, this idea of the people that I just it propels my purpose. Right. It undergirds my purpose in education in terms of really helping students through Black students, specifically through teaching them their history and culture, teaching them to recognize their inherent nobility, providing them with that proper education so they do begin to understand their nobility and are able to manifest the pupil of the eye. Because again, you know, I go back, you know, these processes of miseducation that have, you know, pretty much educated us away from ourselves, out of our minds, perpetuates and the system hinges on that misidentification. And so, you know, it's important that our Black people are reintroduced to the true essence of who they are, which has to do with our spiritual destiny and with our cultural greatness.
And it goes back to nobility in my mind. You know, when you consider the heroes of the Black movement, and when you consider the heroes of the faith, none of these souls consider themselves as victims. And they always maintain a noble spirit. And the nobility of spirit, even though it's one of the 10 cardinal virtues is freedom from resentment under the experience of persecution, freedom from resentment under the experience of wrong. That's a universal principle that we'll talk about later when we used to teach the young brothers, is that when you fall into victimhood, you fall into resentment. When you fall into resentment, you've fallen into the trap of, losing your designation of pupil of the eye. Pupil of the eye, you know, that spiritual designation means that I maintain my nobility regardless of whatever is going on, you know, that I can continually navigate the situation because I depend on my spiritual qualities to guide me and not some type of political ideology that or some type of framework that operates out of being a victim, you know. So you, one has to really pay attention to oneself to really be able to, you have to know yourself and know when you're moving into that place that is going to take you there to where, you know, you're angry, you are upset, you you know, I'm not saying I never been I have, but I always have to realign my spirit with who Baha'u'llah say I am. You know, I've gotten real angry, you know, but it's always been this thing of being able to, this is not who I am. This is not how to get it done. This is not, you know, I have to realign myself with that spiritual designation, you know, being pupil of the eye, you know what I mean? So that's pretty much, that is the goal, that or that space that I have to always kind of see myself in or bring me back to where I need to be in order to, you know, move forward with who we are, black people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What Pops just said, you know, makes me think about, you know, in a prayer from the, that Baha'u'llah revealed in the tablet, it's called the Tablet of Ahmad. And in that tablet, Baha'u'llah says, remember my days during thy days and my distress and banishment in this remote prison. You know, Baha'u'llah, the prophet from the Baha'i faith, suffered in exile and imprisonment for 40 years of his life. And in this tablet, he's calling upon us to remember his days, right? Remember those things. Remember my banishment in this prison. But right after that, he says, and be thou so steadfast in my love that thy heart shall not waver, even if the swords of the enemy's rain blows upon thee. And when I think about that within the context of the black experience, and I think about that in the context of the pupil of the eye, the things that we've endured, right? We remember those things, right? Not in the sense of, you know, like Pops was saying, to be angry or to be bitter or these types of things. But when we think about how we are refined, right? We are refined through tests and difficulty, and that refines us to be able to, matter of fact, there's another in a tablet where, you know, Baha'u'llah in the fire tablet, he talks about, if it wasn't for the cold, how would the heat of thy words prevail? Or not for calamity, how would the sun of thy same presence shine? So it's through that calamity, through those tests that you know, we are reveal these this resilience and this ability to see differently. Matter of fact, Dr. Cornel West often says, you know, the condition of truth is when we allow suffering to speak. So when we allow those who have suffered, those who've gone through, there's a certain wisdom that comes out of that. And so, you know, when I think about even this designation of pupil of the eye, we think about, you know, this misidentity that we've been fed, right? This this misinformation about who we are. When Baha'u'llah, it's like a divine reparation, so to speak, right? To repair, you know, how we have been conditioned to say, look, you know, it's through you that the cause of God in this day, you have a special purpose and a special role within the cause of God as the pupil of the eye. And it is a direct result, and from the way I look at it, from how we have been prepared through struggle. So, you know, we're not victims. You know, it was preparation to be at the vanguard of the cause of God for this day.
Man, you know, man, y'all got me thinking, man. Thinking about, you know, talking about moving forward, brother. So we've got this, you know, in the Baha'i community, Baha'i world community, we've got this framework for action, right? Which is really dedicated to transforming our communities, right? In a fundamentally profound way, helping to spiritualize our communities so they look different, they feel different, they operate differently than from a material worldview, right? And I'm thinking about the role of, of the eradication of racism, you know, which has been described as America's most vital and challenging issue in the Baha'i writings. Vital in terms of importance, in terms of how that refers to the biology of the body, vital signs, right? Challenging because it's writ large into every fabric, you know, every stitch of the American quilt. It's in there, right? And I'm wondering, you know, this framework for action, which includes things like, you know, devotional gatherings, children's classes, junior youth empowerment workshops, study of the sacred text. How do you see the issue of the eradication of racism being an integral part of that process? And how does, and in addition to that, I would ask, how do you think these initiatives help to heal.
Absolutely, brother. One of those core activities that you mentioned is the Junior Youth Spiritual Empowerment Program. And this program is for young people between the ages of 12 to 15. That's designed to help them to develop spiritual perception, help them to be able to read the reality around them and to be able to act upon it to create change. Right. So it's a program designed to create change agents. And so we actually, my pops and I, we had an organization, one of the junior youth groups for a very long time, from like 96 until I think that group was until about 2008 or something like that, or maybe a little bit beyond that. But one of the things is that within that program, you know, we were able to do exactly what you're talking about, particularly with African-American youth, to help them to, as I've been talking about throughout our whole interview here, this whole idea of developing a positive self-identity. So we used the Junior Youth Program to do just that, right? So the program was based on the principles of the Nguzo Saba, which are seven principles that were put together by Brother Malana Karinga when he created the Kwanzaa holiday. And they include Umoja, unity, Kujichagulia, self-determination, Ujima, collective work responsibility, Ujamaa, cooperative economics, Kumba, creativity, Nia, purpose, Imani, and faith, right? Which all of these principles are aligned with, you know, the spiritual principles of the faith and every other major religion and every other spiritual system. These principles are a central part of it. But those, you know, so those principles, however, were connected with Africa, right? So we wanted the kids to have a connection with their African identity, to be able to connect with that and be able to see how that connects now to their current time and space, right? So it was a process of teaching them about the Middle Passage. Well, first of all, teaching them who we were prior to European contact, right? Teaching them what happened to us as a result of it. And then you contextualizing their current reality within that trajectory so they can see the condition of my community today is not a result of me being Black and locating that deficit within themselves, but it was as a result of processes that were intentionally put in place to maintain social hierarchies and maintain a system of white supremacy. And so helping them to understand that, and then helping them to see, okay, now what are the necessities at this point for me, for my own self-empowerment, right? Through my education, through, you know, my moral behavior, through all these things, to then serve the community, to combat these forces and to build a better world. And so that's how we use the Junior Youth Program to do that, you know, particularly as it relates to, you know, dealing with Black youth. And dealing with Black youth is race unity, right? There are some people may look at that, or how can you focus on? No, it was an African-centered program, which everybody can benefit from. There were white brothers and sisters in that group as well that benefited from what we were doing. Persians as well that were part of it. So, you know, so that was the context of that group, right? Where there are some other groups that are, you know, aligned to the same thing, but there's a certain intentionality that has to happen in order for the outcome to be what it needs to be, right? Particularly as it relates to race. You got to be intentional in study circle, intentional in devotional gatherings, intentional in children's classes. Otherwise, you're kind of just going through, you know, not necessarily going through the motions, but you're going through the material, going through, right? You're gaining from it. It's definitely beneficial, but you got to be intentional if we want to address the most vital and challenging issue, racism, in those activities.
That's powerful stuff that you both have shared, man. I'm thinking about, you know, as we're doing this deep excavation, right? We're in this moment right now, right? Where society at large, not just in the Baha'i community, but society generally, is excavating the complex historical narrative that is America, right? That has had this peculiar orientation towards the truth, right? I'm thinking about, you know, since truthfulness within the Baha'i faith is the foundation of all human virtues, and it has to take precedence, all the other virtues are built upon that, whether you're talking about courage, humility, love, compassion, so forth and so on. And I'm thinking about this idea of difficult conversations, man. And historically, when it comes to the issue of race, how we have been deeply invested in comfort and not wanting to engage in difficult conversation. So we have danced around, slipped, dipped, moved to the side, evaded, you know, whatever we needed to do to avoid these difficult conversations. And we talk about the spiritual distinction of Black folks being the pupil of the eye, which to me, in some sense, is synonymous with the light of truth, right? So we are invested in the truth, and we're looking to have, the Black community is looking to have meaningful conversations. How do we, you know, go about this process of encouraging, cajoling, demanding that our white brothers and sisters develop a healthy disrespect for comfort?
I guess what comes to mind first, you know, I guess I can speak in context of the Baha'i community in and of itself, right? We've been given these divine principles by Baha'u'llah, right? The oneness of humanity is the pivot around which all of the other teachings revolve in the Baha'i faith. So ultimately, we know in essence that we have a shared vision for humanity, which, you know, when we talk about these difficult conversations and the need to have these conversations, you know, we, you know, it's, I guess it's, you know, because you have a common goal or common aim or common vision, you know, that's, you know, people who say they believe, right? You know, matter of fact, it's written in the Book of Certitude in the Kitab-e-Gun. It says, you know, do you think that we can say, you can just say we believe and you shall not be put to proof? And so the proof in the pudding is the fact that, you know, we need to have this dialogue. You know what I mean? We got to talk about it. You got to deal with it. You got to get in the trenches. And so, you know, which then, you know, at least gives them that type of perspective. Now, when we talk about, you know, the general community and having these conversations, right, there is a bit more nuanced. There's a lot more involved in that, you know, because people are coming from all types of spaces. And what I'm seeing now, particularly around me, is that most people are moving from a political space, right? They're not looking at racism as a moral issue or issue of morality. They're looking at it as an issue of right and left, Democrat, Republic, red, blue, you know. And so those conversations require, you know, for those who are willing to engage, for those white brothers that are willing to engage, requires, you know, the ability to help them to see this as a moral issue, a spiritual issue, and not a political issue, right? That the destiny of their own destiny, the destiny of humanity is linked to that of everyone else, particularly when we look at humanity as one body, the body politic, which we've mentioned here before. And so, you know, it's a matter of being willing to engage in those conversations, right? Or, you know, a lot of times, you know, I get sick of having to persuade people that a problem exists, right? From having to persuade them that, you know, Black lives do matter and it's a problem when things happen to us, particularly at the hands of those who are supposed to serve and protect us, right? There's a problem when the inequities impact our community in the way it does. It seems like people would have that empathy, you know. So it's a matter of how do I, you know, open myself up to be willing to have those conversations to be able to, you know, stimulate that empathy within our brothers and sisters. But right now, this current moment is a bit somewhat promising, right? As we see these conversations being held amongst, you know, all diverse parts of our society, which is opening up a moment of opportunity, you know, which our House of Justice says a moment of historic portent, right? So this is ripe. So I feel like you know, we're ready. Right? I feel like people are ready to engage in this conversation, but we got to get out there and be willing to have it with everybody to bring this principle of oneness of humanity more in line in order to reform our society.
Wow, that's wonderful. I'm thinking about, you know, the steps towards racial healing in this country as, you know, designated by the Guardian of the Baha'i Faith. I should tell our listeners, the Guardian was appointed the head of the faith after the passing of his grandfather, Abdu'l-Bahá, who was the son of Baha'u'lláh, the prophet founder of the faith. The Guardian said that there are steps that blacks and whites have to take in this process, right? And they are interdependent. And it's interesting the order that he delivers this medication. He says whites first have to prove themselves to be trustworthy. And then blacks have to demonstrate a readiness to forgive once they have proven that they are trustworthy, essentially. And it seems to me that the faith, amongst the many brilliant ways that it engages around the issue of the eradication of racism, the oneness of mankind, is that it clearly delineates that both groups have skin in the game.
I refer back again to, a recent message we got from the Universal House of Justice. And at the very end of the message, it said, that which is confirmed is the oneness of humanity. And, that line has been resonating with me since I read it, particularly when we look at, what's happening around us, when we look at the long history of racism and, we look at the current realities, sometimes, this idea of hope, right? Is it going to change? All my efforts, contributing to some sort of change. And so that line alone, just lets me know the oneness of humanity is inevitable, right? We will get there. And when it says the arc of the universe bends towards justice, right? The spirit of humanity bends towards oneness. And so, in spite of all that we see, everything going on, stay the course. I just want to encourage everybody, anybody that's listening to this, and I'm really speaking to myself as well. Sometimes, you're trying to figure out, what do I do? How can I, how do I do this? But that which is confirmed is the oneness of humanity. And so, it's just like the force of gravity. No matter how much you jump in the air, you try to resist it, what goes up must come down. That force is real. And so the oneness of humanity, that spiritual principle, operates the same way. So we're gonna stay the course.
That's wonderful, man. Thank you guys so much for spending a little time with me, man, and with our listening audience, and just sharing, man, giving of yourselves. Thank you for the work that you do, Baba Nassif, in restorative justice in the criminal justice system. Brother Dr. Anthony, in your job as an educator, man, as an administrator. I mean, two critical areas that we need, insight and wisdom, and just to really see the potential and the best in people, no matter where they come from. So I really appreciate you, man, for the work that you guys do, and love you both. You know that already, but I'm going to tell you anyway, love you both, and respect you both as well. You've been listening to America's Most Challenging Issue. I'm your host, Masoud Olufani. And remember, racism is a profound deviation from the standard of true morality. It deprives a portion of humanity of the opportunity to cultivate and express the full range of their capability and to live a meaningful life, a flourishing life, while blighting the progress of the rest of humankind. From the Baha'i Writings, thank you so much for joining us. Until next time.